Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode, sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate is doing a telepathic interview with the late John Phillips and his co-author Jim Jerome to discuss his memoir, Papa John. Email us at letterrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and we're doing another telepathic episode this week because both John Phillips and his co-author, Jim Jerome, are deceased. And I'm talking about the book Papa John, A Music Legend's Shattering Journey Through Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. I also used Michelle Phillips's California Dreamin' as a source for this episode. And this is one I wanted to do before the series ended. I had never been into the Mamas and the Papas growing up, other than, you know, of course, I knew the hits from the radio, from oldies radio. But they weren't, even though they were massively big in 66, 67, they were kind of from another era that I wasn't into. Like Mama Cass had a lot of showbiz type stuff, and it was a harmony group. I didn't really understand how harmony groups worked. I liked folk rock fine, but I liked it, you know, with a band like the Byrds, where they were a vocal harmony group and a band. Ditto for the Beatles, a vocal harmony group and a band. Whereas I didn't really understand or appreciate vocal harmony groups growing up. I would see, you know, groups like the Temptations or the Jackson Five, and my initial thinking was, you know, that the people playing the instruments were the talented ones, and I didn't understand how singers could be musically talented too, which is pretty stupid, but that's where I was coming from as a kid. And in my big 60s phase in the 80s and 90s, I tried the Mamas and the Papas, but I found the full-length albums, like the version of Twist and Shout or Dancing in the Streets, were just feeble to me. And when they would do Sing for Your Supper and other kind of Broadway songs like that, it just reeked of old-school showbiz that I didn't dig. But for some reason, about 10 years ago, I got a hold of John Phillips' autobiography and Michelle Phillips' autobiography at the same time, and I read them back to back. And found them utterly fascinating because both of those people, and Michelle Phillips is still alive, so I'll have to watch what I say a little bit about her. But John Phillips was certainly an effing scumbag to the nth degree. And reading her memoir, it was pretty clear why she ended up with somebody like that, that she fit right in. And John Phillips is one of these people who, his autobiography is really interesting, really charming. He seems likable. But when you think about what he's describing that he's done, it's pretty appalling. He was born in Alexandria, Virginia. His father was an ex-Marine, I believe drill sergeant, or maybe captain, and a World War I veteran. And his mother was a Cherokee that his father had met on the reservation, although she was adopted by her Cherokee parents. And it's not ever clear if John Phillips actually had Cherokee blood in him or not, if his mother was biologically Caucasian or what. But either way, his father's alcoholism reduced his father to complete non-functional, to being completely dysfunctional. And when World War II broke out, his father tried to get back into shape and go back into the military, but he'd had some heart problems and couldn't get back in. And once he failed that physical for World War II, he just devoted himself to the bottle. And so John Phillips grew up with his father spending all day in the basement with a bottle of booze and his mother out working two or three jobs, plus dating other men sometimes. And so had this completely dysfunctional childhood. And you know, becomes like a 50s era juvenile delinquent. He's about the same age as Elvis and Frankie Valli. So like Frankie Valli, he doesn't become a famous rock star until he's older. And even older than Frankie Valli. Frankie Valli got big in 62. John Phillips doesn't get big until 66, 67. And it wasn't for lack of trying. But so in the 50s, he's this classic car stealing, you know, juvenile delinquent greaser type kid. And but music is his way out. And one thing that's interesting about his autobiography, and Keith Richards kind of did this too, was he grew up as this, you know, child of alcoholics in this totally dysfunctional house who's embarrassed to bring people to. And he starts the book out in Long Island in 1980 when he has descended to the depths of heroin addiction and he's become this massive drug dealer. He's talked like 6 to 8 family pharmacies into filling out, you know, prescriptions for him at will. And he would swap cocaine for prescription medicines and was doing it at such a scale that he ended up getting busted by the exact same narcotics task force that busts Henry Hill in Goodfellas, like the helicopters, the whole bit. And, you know, Keith Richards has a line about how John Phillips was the kind of guy that you'd turn him onto heroin and 6 months later, he's the biggest dealer in the Long Island area. And that seems to be the case. And, you know, Phillips had to do some jail time and kind of got off with a plea, but all of those pharmacists had their lives ruined and their careers destroyed because they were busted along with him. And, you know, that's just a sample of the kind of carnage that John Phillips left in his wake everywhere he went. Music biz wise, he comes out of the folk movement, the post 1959 Kingston Trio era folk movement, when folk was this big gold mine. And he had a group called the Journeymen with himself, a guy named Dick Wiseman, who was the instrumentalist, and a guy named Scott McKenzie, who would go on to become a popular singer in the late 60s, singing John Phillips' songs, most famously, If You're Going to San Francisco, Be Sure and Put a Flower in Your Hair, which was the theme song for the Monterey Pop Festival. That group had a pretty good run. They made some money songwriting for the Kingston Trio and others, or Phillips did, and put out albums and toured. But then the group fell apart because Scott McKenzie basically had mental health problems. And so, and around this time, Phillips meets this 18-year-old girl, Michelle, soon to be Michelle Phillips, in San Francisco. And he's already married and has kids, and his long-suffering wife is left at home through all this. And he abandons her and the family to marry 18-year-old Michelle Phillips. And he forms a group called the New Journeymen with Michelle and banjoist Marshall Brickman. And that goes along pretty well because Phillips is a great harmony vocal arranger. Michelle Phillips was a stunning beauty and a fine singer. And Marshall Brickman was a really talented multi-instrumentalist. But Marshall Brickman had another career going. He was a comedy writer. And he got an offer to be the head writer on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. And he took it. And that was the end of the New Journeymen. Meanwhile, Cass Elliot is this, you know, hefty, larger woman, large size woman who is in a group called the Big Three that's working the same circuits. She's in the in this group with a guy named Tim Rose, who wrote the song Morning Dew, or has his name on the copyright for the song Morning Dew, which was made famous by Rod Stewart and Jeff Beck and others. And then another singer, John Brown. And then later it was Cass Elliot, Tim Rose, and James Hendricks in the Big Three. Sometimes they put out records as Cass Elliot and the Big Three. And then that fell apart and she forms a folk rock group with Zal Yanofsky, who's going to go on to become the guitarist in 11 Spoonful, and Denny Doherty, who's going to go on to become the lead vocalist in the Mamas and the Papas. And this group was called the Mugwumps. They played New York and the circuit, and they played some of the same gigs with the New Journeymen, and the foursome gets to know each other, John and Michelle and Cass and Denny Doherty. And, you know, John and Michelle are having this torrid honeymoon, and Cass Elliot and Denny Doherty are having this torrid platonic affair because Denny's not attracted to her physically, but he's in love with her emotionally. And the four of them become friends and have this pivotal experience where Cass Elliot brings LSD to a party. And this is 1964. So they're pretty hip. They're like a year ahead of the Beatles here. And they play the Beatles for John Phillips. And John Phillips has been an old fuddy-duddy and didn't like the Beatles. And then he drops acid and hears Meet the Beatles and his world changes. And they decide to form a folk rock group. But John Phillips is a fat shamer and fat phobic, and he doesn't want to be in a band with a woman like Cass Elliot, who's heavy. And they go to the Virgin Islands, and Cass follows them and spends 6 months working on a song. But let's hear one of their songs. This is a song called No Salt on Her Tail, which is about Michelle Phillips and John Phillips's way of dealing with her promiscuousness was to give her a pass. If, you know, she started cheating on him basically the first time he turned his back on her. And, you know, I think the first time he went away for a weekend with his group, she has an affair. And is, you know, reading her autobiography, she's completely ice cold about this. This is just what I wanted to do, and I did it, and no problem. So this is the Mamas and the Papas, No Salt on Her Tail. And that was No Salt on Her Tail by the Mamas and the Papas. And you can hear the brilliant harmonies, and you can hear the L.A. Wrecking Crew backing them up. Some of the best, Hal Blaine and company, playing on those records. And they go to the Virgin Islands and spend most of 1965 workshopping their material, playing in a club on the island. They had some money from Phillips's songwriting success, and he has credit cards, and they basically end up maxing those cards out. They're spending the whole summer dropping acid. Phillips brings his children, Mackenzie Phillips, and his son, I think James, and these poor children are just left as feral. They're not taken care of at all by their druggy parents. And, you know, John Phillips is the kind of dad who would leave cocaine out on the table. And if the kids got into it, well, cool, let the kids have some fun. This just, as a Gen Xer, this is just tooth grindingly obnoxious, bad parenting, bad parenting. And we'll talk about the incest allegations that Mackenzie Phillips made later on, but I want to be clear that she never accused her father of molesting her as a child. That what happened was they had an affair when they were both adults, adult crackheads, but adults. I'm not trying to make any excuses for John Phillips. I think he's the biggest piece of shit you could possibly be as a human being, but I just want to be clear that's what Mackenzie Phillips has alleged, and nobody's accused him of being a child molester, although just a mega creep and terrible parent. But anyway, they form this group, and eventually Cass Elliott works her way in. She's working she goes and gets a job as a waitress in the club they're playing in, and starts singing from the floor and joining in. And she's so popular and obviously a great singer that they have to let her in. And they come up with what's believed to be a cover story. Cass Elliott swore this was true her whole life, but the story is that her voice was a little bit too low to sing the harmony parts that John Phillips was hearing in his head. And then one day a bucket falls on her head and she gets a brain injury, and suddenly she has three notes added to her range at the top. And suddenly she can sing and she's welcomed into the group. That's widely believed to be BS, and that the real story was that John Phillips was just deeply uncomfortable about being in a group with a woman that was plus sized like Cass was. Ultimately, in the end, Cass Elliott, Mama Cass, goes on to be the biggest star in the group and proved him wrong. And that's pretty satisfying, because it's interesting that, you know, John and Michelle are people that it's easy to dislike, but it's very hard to dislike Cass Elliott. You know, she was this earth mother who kind of, you know, becomes this big star. She's very frustrated because, you know, she's got this love relationship with Denny Doherty, but he doesn't reciprocate, at least not physically. And then what John Phillips did know at this point is that Michelle and Denny had started having a physical affair, and Michelle and Cass are having this incredibly close, almost obsessive friendship with each other. Cass Elliott is really educating Michelle, and Michelle really looks up to her and loves her and goes ahead and has an affair with the love of Cass's life anyway. But they get to LA before this is exposed, or before John and Cass are aware of what's going on. And they get to LA. This guy, Barry McGuire, who's a friend of John's from the folk circuit, has just had a massive number one hit with a song called Eve of Destruction, written by P.F. Sloan, recorded by Lou Adler at Dunhill Records. We've talked about Lou Adler and this whole circle on several episodes, and Lou Adler's one of the you know, hippest hitmakers in LA, and this excellent record producer. He's got the Wrecking Crew, you know, at his fingertips, one phone call away anytime he needs to cut a session. They show up at his office, and Kim Fowley, the legendary scumbag who behind the song Alley Oop and later puts together the Runaways, is trying to sign the Mamas and the Papas. They pulled up to his house first, and he's trying to hustle around and get the money together and get a deal together. And he gets it together the next day. But in the meantime, the Mamas and the Papas have taken a ride up to the Dunhill Records offices, and Lou Adler's already signed them. So they're instantly this hot property when they get to LA and people hear their material. And it's no surprise. It's things like California Dreamin' and Monday. And you know, Andrew Lou Goldham, the Rolling Stones manager, was in those offices a few days later and got to be one of the first people to hear what he called their national anthems, and was blown away. And you know, immediately tells the Stones, wow, there's this great folk rock group that's cutting records on Dunhill, and they're going to be a big thing. And sure enough, they were. They massive smash hits right out the gate. They originally were going to provide California Dreamin' to Barry McGuire as this follow-up to Eve of Destruction, but McGuire had this really growly bass singing style, and the more that John Phillips and Lou Adler listened to it, the more they were unhappy. It had the angelic Mamas and the Papas backing vocals, but McGuire, and in particular his harmonica break on the song, just weren't cutting it. So Phillips and Adler wipe off McGuire's vocal take and his harmonica part and re-record, keep the backing and the backing vocals, and just get Denny Doherty in there to record a new lead vocal and bring in a flautist, a jazz flute player. He was actually a brass player, played saxophone as well. And they bring him in, and he picked the flute and you know, the epic legendary flute solo on California Dreamin'. That becomes this massive hit. Then Monday becomes even a bigger hit. And then John Phillips and Cass Elliott realize what's going on with Michelle and Denny behind their backs. And literally no sooner is the group exploding than they implode, because that betrayal completely broke Cass Elliott's heart. It enraged John Phillips. He was willing to look the other way with Michelle's philandering. He was an older man, et cetera, et cetera. She's this young beauty. He understands. But when push comes to shove and she's sleeping with the guy in his group, he just can't handle it. And they keep going. But then in the summer of 66, she starts having an affair with Gene Clark, the lead vocalist of the Byrds. And they do a gig, and Gene Clark is sitting in the front row in this bright red and purple suit. And John Phillips sees his wife making eyes at Gene Clark and fires her on the spot, just cannot handle it. And so for like 6 months, from July of 66 until October of 66, they bring in this woman named Jill Gibson. And we talked about Jill Gibson on the episode we did with Joel Selvin that was mostly focused on Jan and Dean. And Jill Gibson had been the partner of Jan, and now I'm forgetting his name. It's Dean Torrance. But she was with Jan. I want to say Barry, but he was the main guy in Jan and Dean, and she had been his partner. And, you know, Jan and Dean's number one hit was Surf City. And the famous chorus, two girls for every boy. And one night Jill Gibson's in her massive house that she shares with Jan, and she hears noises, and usually he's in the studio and she hears noises, but she's hearing noises from the other side of the house. So she gets worried somebody's broken in. She goes to their hot tub room, and there's Jan with two girls. So that was enough for her. She leaves Jan and she becomes Lou Adler's girlfriend. And that's when Lou Adler introduces her to John Phillips, and she's a great singer and becomes a member of the Mamas and the Papas, and even goes to London with them, and they're the big hit of the scene. And so it's time for our next song, and this is the Mamas and the Papas doing a song called Strange Young Girls, which somebody who's been fascinated with the Manson family my whole life, I immediately zeroed in on this song. And according to Michelle Phillips, the Manson girls were creepy crawling in the alley behind their house and were a known entity on the Sunset Strip. And so John Phillips writes the song Strange Young Girls about, you know, Sadie Mae Glutz and the different Manson girls before Sharon Tate gets killed. So he was aware of the Manson family, and he put it in song. Strange Young Girls at the Altar of Acid. This is the Mamas and the Papas. And that was Strange Young Girls by the Mamas and the Papas, a song I just find unbelievably eerie. And this is one of the songs that sold me on Michelle Phillips, not Michelle Phillips, on John Phillips as a songwriting talent. This guy had a real gift for observing life and putting it into song. And, you know, in the Me Too era, which I was reading it at the beginning of the Me Too era, and I feel like the Me Too era has kind of ended and turned into this hideous reactionary backlash. But it was a real struggle for me to reconcile my hatred for this guy. Just, you know, reading this book, it was a lot like when I read Eugene S. Robinson's memoir. I just found myself hating this guy. And at the same time, I was listening to his music for the first time with open ears and really enjoying it and admiring his abilities as a songwriter. So it's a complicated thing. And you know, millions of people reacted to John Phillips and the group's gifts in a positive way. And they were very much pre-hippie icons. They really laid the groundwork for American culture to embrace, or at least youth culture to embrace hippies and the San Francisco scene. And Phillips, you know, no sooner do the Mamas and the Papas become one of America's most popular groups, but Phillips kind of becomes the king of LA. He called himself the Wolf King of LA. And he's just a mover and a shaker. And he and Lou Adler get wind of this plan to organize the Monterey Pop Festival and very quickly move in and take it over and turn it into a charitable show where none of the acts are getting paid, which is one of the reasons they couldn't get very many black acts. Like Otis Redding is a big exception. Like nobody from Motown, even though Smokey Robinson was on their board, nobody from Motown came to play. And a lot of it was the money. The black acts were just like, you know, they were working and they wanted to get paid for their work and they weren't going to fall for any kind of free show BS. But it ends up becoming this mammoth cultural moment when not only does Otis Redding become a star with white America for the first time after nearly, you know, half a decade of being at the top of the R&B charts, but not getting a sniff of the pop charts. And it's almost immediately before his unfortunate death, but also The Who and Jimi Hendrix breakthrough at Monterey. Jimi Hendrix had to go, you know, Hendrix was somebody who'd been on the R&B circuit for years, playing with people like Don Covey and Little Richard and you know, really putting in his time and woodshedding. But there was really no place in R&B for what Jimi Hendrix really wanted to do, which was combine, you know, the kind of electric guitar adventurousness that he was hearing coming out of England from people like Dave Davies of the Kinks and, you know, Jeff Beck of the Yardbirds and others. And he wants to combine that with what Bob Dylan's doing, and he has to go to England to do it. But then they form Chas Chandler of the Animals becomes his manager. They form the Experience around Jimmy, and he's the hottest thing in London. And so when they invite Andrew Lew Goldham to be on the board of the Monterey Pop Festival and Paul McCartney, both of those Brits were like, you've got to get Jimi Hendrix on the bill. And they do. And they also say, you've got to get The Who on the bill. And they do. And The Who has their first American breakthrough around this time with I Can See for Miles and Miles. And Janis Joplin and the San Francisco acts also have big breakthroughs. And Janis Joplin was with Big Brother and the Holding Company, and they have this massive breakout performance there, and she becomes a star. And it's filmed for a movie. And so it's a massive concert event. I think, you know, 50 to 100,000 people see it live. But then it becomes this movie that's released in 68. And so Janis Joplin just becomes a bigger and bigger star over the course of the thing. The problem was that the Mamas and the Papas hadn't been rehearsing. They had become this studio act. John Phillips is this obsessive perfectionist, and it becomes real torture for them to make music. And they're, you know, they're very divided. They're all for Rich and Famous, and Denny Doherty's becoming, you know, a heavy drinker and living in a mansion with all these hangers on. And Mama Cass has all these hangers on, including lots of boyfriends that people suspected were just after her for her money. She gets pregnant and has a baby. She and John Phillips are just at loggerheads all the time. Michelle Phillips is really bummed out about the experience of having been fired, and, you know, doesn't feel like she has any agency in the group after that, that John's got her under his thumb completely. They reconciled and were living together again, and they buy this big mansion in Bel Air. And they have more Manson family encounters. Like when Michelle Phillips tells a story of one night, she's looking out the front window and she sees people dressed in black crawling up the driveway to their Bel Air mansion. And she freaks out and runs and gets John, who's in the studio he'd built in the pool house out back. and she runs against John Phillips. And John Phillips is this guy who's like 6'5". He's a Navy veteran. He's completely insane and evil. He grabs a shotgun, jumps in his Jeep, which has a big spotlight on it, roars into his comes out the back of the house, and this thing roars up onto the driveway, spotlights these people that are creepy crawling into the house, you know, cocks his shotgun and tells him in no uncertain terms to go somewhere else. And that was apparently Tex Watson, I mean, and Susan Atkins, aka Sadie Mae Glutz. This was the Manson family doing a full on creepy crawl of their house. And you know, they learned not to come back to John Phillips's house because dude was scarier than they were. But let's take a sponsor break. When we come back, I'll talk about the collapse of the band and what John Phillips did afterwards.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And we're back to continue talking about John Phillips and the rest of the Mamas and the Papas. And so the group continues to have hits sporadically, but there's definitely a feeling that they're behind the times and that they're he's struggling to keep up. And he's this obsessive perfectionist. And you know, it's one thing to compete with like the Birds and the Turtles and the Leaves and the Grassroots and the LA folk rock scene and Bob Dylan. But just 1 year later, it's 1967. And suddenly they're competing with Sgt. Pepper's and Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, even the Rolling Stones are having trouble keeping up in this rapidly changing time. And all the San Francisco bands, I mean, the Jefferson Airplane explodes out of San Francisco with Somebody to Love and White Rabbit. Grace Slick is suddenly, you know, this dark-haired, pretty openly evil or openly rebellious singer, and very much a counterpoint to Mama Cass and Michelle Phillips, and then you get Janis Joplin, who won't get an album out on a major label until 1968, but Big Brother and the Holding Company are touring, and a very big deal. And another group from San Francisco, a favorite of mine, Moby Grape, actually tours briefly with the Mamas and the Papas, and their show is so exciting and, vibrant that John Phillips kicked him off the bill after just a few gigs. This is one of several stumbles that causes Moby Grape to go from the next big thing to who were they? That, Monterey Pop Festival played a role in that, because at one point their manager is insisting that if they're going to be filmed, they want $100,000 cash and all these other demands. And basically John Phillips and Lou Adler just told him to get stuffed, and they moved them off the bill. Moby Grape was supposed to be one of the headliners on Saturday night, and they moved them to the very opening slot of the entire festival. And so they basically get no attention at all from Monterey Pop. And it's just one of several stumbles that brings Moby Grape down. And they never, have a hit. But anyway, back to the 67. And also Jim Morrison and the Doors have had a massive hit with Light My Fire. So it's very difficult for John Phillips to keep up. But nonetheless, they do manage to have hits. But they're, they go from a band that their first three singles are all top 10. Their fourth single only goes to the top 30. Then they have another top 5 single. Then their version of Dance in the Streets flops, only gets to number 73. And so they cover the Five Royales and do a song called Dedicated to the One I Love. And that makes it to number 2. But that also elevates Mama Cass, because she's clearly the big singer on that. And then they do a self-referential song called Creek Alley, which tells the story of the Mamas and the Papas. And again, I think it's just brilliant lyric writing from John Phillips. And that becomes a pretty big hit at number 5. But then their next single goes to number 20, the next one to 26. Then they have a song called Dancing Bear that only makes it to number 51, Safe in My Garden, 53. And then they have one last single, Dream a Little Dream of Me, that's basically a Mama Cass solo song. And it goes to number 12 and really primes her for a solo career. And the group is just falling apart. Denny Doherty's a total alcoholic by this point. Michelle Phillips and John are at each other's throats, and John Phillips has discovered cocaine. And, they've got two of the biggest noses in Hollywood snorting away. And it's a fascinating book if you like scurrilous gossip. I mean, there's things like, and I'm blanking on the name of the director, but there was a director who had kind of directed Brigitte Bardot's movies, and then he marries Jane Fonda and directs Barbarella And according to John Phillips and Michelle Phillips both, they had a fivesome with, I think it was Roger Vadim was the director, this handsome, studly French movie director, Jane Fonda at the peak of her beauty, and Warren Beatty shows up. And then John and Michelle decide, well, what the heck, let's party and have this big five-way orgy. So this is the kind of life they're living, where it's celebrity excess to the nth degree. And, and their kids are living in this with no chaperoning or filter. I mean, the cocaine's just left out on the table. The kids come in, don't get in my cocaine, kids. You've got your own pot allowance, and that kind of that was his idea of strict parenting. And things happen, like, Mackenzie Phillips has alleged that Mick Jagger seduced her when she was 13 or 14 years old. Maybe she was 15. I can't remember. But and don't sue me, sir, Mick. That was Mackenzie that said that. Not me. I have no idea if that's true or not, but it does have the ring of truth, and it's a very believable story. And, this is just this kind of unfettered lifestyle that they're living. Anyway, Cass Elliot has this hit. She's very successful on variety shows, and she's becoming more and more of a star in her own right. So the band breaks up, and, they do a fourth album, and that flops. And Cass Elliot tries to go solo. And she is so strung out, and she's been dieting, these crazy binge diets, and she basically wrecks her health. And John Phillips and Michelle go to Vegas to support her for her big Vegas debut. And this is before Elvis even played Vegas. So rock and roll in Vegas have not come to terms yet. And it turns out that Mama Cass has been so obsessed with her figure that she's wrecked her health. She hasn't rehearsed an act. She hasn't been singing. The people that are, her music director is not, John Phillips is like, this is not working, Cass. You need to not do the show. And she goes ahead and does it, and it's a flop. It's a disaster. She pretty much collapses on stage. And, she does manage to build some of her solo career back, but it's not what it could have been because of that big flop at Vegas. But here's a single that she put out early in her solo career that I really am fond of. This is California Earthquake by Mama Cass. That was Mama Cass's solo single, California Earthquake. The band has broken up, but they owe Dunhill one more album. And it's Dunhill's been bought by ABC at this point. And, you know, Lou Adler's not necessarily directly in charge anymore. And there's a lot of pressure on the Mamas and the Papas. They're going to get sued for hundreds of thousands of dollars if they don't do one more album. So they do one final album in the early 70s, People Like Us, that totally flops. And overshadows John Phillips' solo album, The Wolf King of L.A., which is a really brilliant album. Denny Doherty was bitter to his dying day that John Phillips didn't bring those songs to the Mamas and the Papas. He thought they were the best set of songs that John Phillips ever wrote, and he didn't feel like John Phillips had the singing voice to handle the lead vocals. I kind of agree, and we'll hear a song from that at the end of the show. I mean, it's just fun to imagine what Denny Doherty and Cass Elliott could have done with these songs. And this is where I learned to appreciate a harmony group, because somebody like Denny Doherty, you know, when you're a guitarist in a band, you can be replaced pretty easily. Instrumentalists are pretty fungible. And, you know, only the very rare virtuosos or somebody like, you know, Willie Nelson's guitar style, there are very few people that have this incredibly recognizable, unique instrumental sound. You know, you could swap out George Harrison for Keith Richards pretty easily on the Beatles and Stones early parts, I think, early records. But you can't replace a harmony vocalist. And somebody like Denny Doherty, somebody like Cass Elliott, somebody like Michelle Phillips, they all had these unique voices and brought their personality to bear. And that's when it clicked for me. Ah, this is what a harmony vocal group is about. This is why it's a big deal. And it immediately opened up worlds for me. Like, suddenly I could appreciate and really dig the Temptations and the Supremes in a whole new way. I'd always appreciated the songwriting and the Funk Brothers and the arrangements and the lead vocals, but I'd never really appreciated the harmony singing and the personalities and the way that the different personalities of the harmony group come forward. And after the Mamas and the Papas opened my ears to that, you know, suddenly I could appreciate the Beach Boys in a whole new way, the Beatles, all of Motown. It suddenly made sense. And I could even appreciate things like Boys to Men and NSYNC and K-pop. And you know, it was a big moment for me in my musical appreciation and opening up new horizons. I'm always looking for new old music, and this really opened my mind. And I'm fascinated by things that they give me conflicting emotions. And John Phillips definitely gave me conflicting emotions, because, you know, as a child of a single mother growing up in the 70s, I'm really bitter about neglectful parents. Not that my mom was neglectful, but she's putting herself through college, raising six kids, et cetera, et cetera. She was busy, and I had a lot of time on my hands. And I was actually looked after better than I realized, that aunts and uncles had their eyes on me, and big brothers and sister were looking out for me too. But nonetheless, I still got myself into some situations that I wish I hadn't. And reading about what McKinsey and China Phillips and all the other children of John Phillips went through was pretty enraging. And, you know, it because I'm me, it added to the fascination of the music. And, you know, Phillips becomes a movie music songwriter and TV. I think he wrote the soundtrack for Brewster McCloud and various different movies. And then he spends a fortune trying to put on a Broadway musical with his second wife, Genevieve. And let's go ahead and hear our last song. This is Let It Bleed, Genevieve, which is a song John Phillips wrote about his second wife, or third wife, Genevieve, miscarrying their child.
Genevieve lay bleeding in my basement. conceiving life again. Up on the sidewalk, a replacement, waiting to be skinned. Bobby wants a lady from the lowlands.
And that was Let It Bleed, Genevieve by John Phillips from his solo album Wolf King of LA. And I mean, you can, I think, hear why he didn't become one of the big singer-songwriters of the early 70s. And also because the Mamas and the Papas got so famous in 1966 and 67, they were kind of frozen in time. Mama Cass was able to kind of sidestep that by becoming a traditional showbiz personality. Sonny and Cher were doing the same thing at the same time. And, you know, variety shows were a huge thing. Things like Laugh-In and The Tonight Show and The Merv Griffin Show and, you know, on and on. There were dozens of TV talk variety shows that you could perform on. And Mama Cass became this beloved American figure in that venue. But John Phillips was stuck very much with the whole peace, love, wear flowers in your hair kind of hippy-dippy thing that was obsolete by 1968. And by 1971, nobody wanted to hear that kind of shit. So, you know, Phillips just ends up being left behind. But being John Phillips, he manages to make a new career for himself in movie soundtrack and TV soundtracks, and has plenty of money left over. You know, all through the 70s, I think he said he had like a six-figure income from the royalties on his songwriting for the Mamas and the Papas and Scott McKenzie and the Kingston Trio, et cetera, et cetera. But he spends all that money on cocaine, and then he starts hanging out with Keith Richards and Mick Jagger, and he's going to do a solo album produced by those two. And, you know, that was a pretty big deal in the mid-70s, and there was, you know, record company interest, and they recorded most of an album, but didn't finish it and came away with a raging heroin habit to go with his already raging cocaine habit. And that's when he becomes a full-on criminal and organizes this massive drug ring and uses his celebrity really cynically to lure these family pharmacists. I mean, he literally targeted pharmacists who are Mamas and the Papas fans and cultivates these friend, quote unquote, friendly relationships with these guys and then dupes these people. And, you know, maybe they knew the score and they were corrupt pharmacists and, you know, I mean, they did it. They gave him, you know, he would get blank prescription forms from doctors and he'd, you know, fill them out, or at least they'd have the book of prescription forms. And that's what busted him, was they were very sloppy about filling them out. So, you know, he would walk in to the pharmacy with a bag of street heroin and walk out and trade that for pharmaceutical grade cocaine and, you know, Dilaudid and all these other substances that he could sell on the street at a big profit and then pay for his own heroin. And, you know, the circle continues all the way up until the time that the Henry Hill helicopters are circling outside his door. You know, having read Keith Richards' memoir about where Richards describes this time in his life, because Richards is about to get busted in Toronto in 1978 for heroin and was looking at serious hard prison time. And there's a period when Richards is living in Long Island and hanging out with John Phillips quite a bit. And they're both living in mansions that they've allowed to go completely decrepit. Like Marlon Richards was a 10-year-old child living with his grandfather, Burt Richards, in this house in Long Island where the bottom floor was completely abandoned and derelict. And they had an elevator up to the second floor, which was their living quarters. But the bills weren't always paid. There wasn't always power. The water, you know, sometimes the plumbing would be out and that kind of stuff. So they're living in this, you know, decadent millionaire squalor. And John Phillips's kids are in a similar situation, even though Mackenzie Phillips by this time has grown up and become a sitcom star in Hollywood, which was really the last thing she needed, because she managed to parlay that into a completely raging coke habit. And Phillips, as part of his PR campaign to declare himself rehabbed and better, he puts together, he gets two of his kids and Denny Doherty, and then they get Spanky from Spanky and Our Gang to replace Cass Elliot. And they put together a new Mamas and the Papas, and they do the talk show rounds, and they talk about, he talks about how he's cleaned up and he's sober. And Mackenzie talks about how she's cleaned up and she's sober. And meanwhile, they're smoking crack every night and having this incestuous affair, which Phillips doesn't admit to. That's only come out since he died and McKenzie made that a public statement. Now, other members of the family, including Michelle Phillips and China Phillips, have all vociferously denied that that happened, but they weren't there. And so I think you got to give some credence to McKenzie Phillips. I mean, who tells a story like that on themselves if they're not true? And then you go, well, it's McKenzie Phillips, so maybe she did it. I have no idea if it's true or not. I wouldn't put it past her to make it up, because just like the Mick Jagger story, I have no idea if that's true or not. I probably shouldn't have even mentioned it on the show. But anyway, unreliable narrators everywhere you look in this story. And, you know, that's pretty much my John Phillips story. This guy was this incredibly gifted songwriter, incredibly gifted harmony arranger, and who absolutely captured the zeitgeist in 1966 and 67 of folk rock turning into flower power. That he was the avatar of that, or really Cass Elliot was the avatar of that, Michelle Phillips and the whole group. And they were avatars of a particular moment in time. Oh, there's one last story I want to tell, which is that Sly Stone ends up buying the Bel Air Mansion from John Phillips. First, he rents it from him, then he leases it, and then he buys it, but he keeps missing so many payments, and somehow Phillips ends up getting more than the value of the house out of Sly Stone, just because Sly Stone is so disorganized and so coked up. And Sly Stone has pit bulls and I believe a baboon or some kind of monkey that lived on the roof of the house and would terrorize people in the driveway. But he also says that he would find things in that house. Like, John Phillips didn't clean up any of his crap. He just let Sly Stone move in with all of John and Michelle's personal belongings in the house, including diaries, tapes of demos and, you know, recording stuff, drug paraphernalia, drugs, all in the house. But Sly Stone was freaked out because he would find things like a closet, a big walk-in closet that had been painted completely red with pentagrams and devil shit in there. And it really freaked Sly Stone out. And this is around the time when Sly Stone is so freaked out that, like, Miles Davis would come over to the house and be in the waiting room, you know, waiting for Sly to come down. And he'd be playing chords. And if, as long as he was playing, you know, major and minor chords, Sly was fine. But then he'd start playing, you know, 11ths and ninths. And Sly felt that that was devil chords and would run down, one time ran down screaming, you know, who's playing them damn devil chords on my piano? Get out of my house, get out of my house. And throws Miles Davis out of the house, where he's then menaced by the pit bulls and monkeys jumping off the roof and barely escapes with his life. So anyway, this is the kind of craziness that John Phillips is at the nexus of, where he's scaring Sly Stone. I mean, Sly Stone scared a ton of people, like Sly and the Family Stone. There's a story about them beating up Three Dog Night one time. I mean, these are pretty rough and ready dudes. And, you know, we did the Sly Stone episode with Joel Selvin, and he's, you know, running with pimps and drug dealers from his neighborhood in Oakland where he grew up. And these people are all afraid of John Phillips. So that's John Phillips for you. And I'm Nate Wilcox. This has been Let It Roll. Our book was Papa John by John Phillips with Jen Jerome. We've been telepathically questioning them about the show since they've both passed on to the next world. And also Michelle Phillips, California Dreamin'. Hope you enjoy the show.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast. And check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, we'll be back with another musical nightmare. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.